You're now listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, broadcasting from sunny Orange County, California. Filmmaker, journalist, and film historian, Paul Booth.
Aloha. Welcome to Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. I'm your host. So happy to be here today. We're going to be interviewing Deborah Campmeyer. Tape is available on Amazon Prime and multiple other platforms. You can check out the review on our website. So I'm looking forward to discussing this today. The director is wonderful. Anything that we say on air today, what I say is my opinion, not that of Deborah or Anna Rosa or her team or her distributor. And what I say is just my opinion in the shows. And have our guests with us. Are you there, Deborah?
I'm here.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for, you know, having me on the show and for your support of the film. I've really enjoyed the conversation that you and Kai had, and I'm really moved by, you know, the comments you made when we were doing our live virtual panels and the engagement you had with this story, which, you know, you've spoken to. But it's important to me to have male allies in the world that we're exploring. And I just feel that you're one of those. So thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. We take that comment with that compliment with a lot of grace. So thank you for that.
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, the film, it's based on a true story. It's set in New York City, and it's about two aspiring actresses who cross paths with, I guess you would say, the darker side of the entertainment industry. It is certainly a Me Too story. So when we made it, we were not setting out to make a Me Too story because the Me Too movement hadn't actually occurred yet. So it was really important to me to give voice to this story that happened to my friend. She's my producing partner. And she actually stars in the role of Rosa in the film. And it follows her attempt to this man who coerced her into having sex with him on camera during a screen test. And she's in the process of trying to catch him and reveal and expose him. And in the process, she ends up stalking, in a way, another actress and collecting footage. We see her editing simultaneously to the event that's occurring that she's filming. And in her attempt to expose him, I think what's important in this story is that she moves from a place of isolation to a place of connection with this other actress and with a whole community of actresses, ultimately, or women, I should say. So that's just a broad stroke of what the film's about.
Thank you for mentioning the dark side. I know we had talked before and had conversations, but I really admire when filmmakers use that as opposed to meeting a creepy guy or dealing with men or, you know, what I had said in my email this morning. I frequently hear that, and it becomes kind of like a frequency of like not turning the radio off, but kind of like how I'm one of those people where it's like, however you present to me, I'm willing to hear whatever you have to say. But, you know, if you're starting out with pure negativity or kind of what you say kind of insults my dad's ethnicity, then it's kind of like, well, you know. So I really like how you've been presenting this as open, as you had mentioned on your panel, safe, even though it's definitely not about an open, safe situation. So you kind of have a duality going on there that I really appreciate in the script and the delivery. What kind of floored me here, as you said, the movement wasn't, the Me Too hadn't happened yet. So my question usually is, how did Me Too affect or not affect the project? So since this was going on before, can you kind of maybe explain a little bit to us what it pushed or pulled, or, you know, what the movement gave the film?
Sure.
Had this going before? That's really interesting.
Well, we wrote the script in 2016, And we put our financing together, super low budget. And then we started pre-production and our financing fell apart. And we were not able to put financing together until Me Too exploded after the Harvey Weinstein allegations came out. And there was so much in the press around what had been occurring to these women behind closed doors. And we, myself and Anna Rosa, who was producing with me, met an investor who said, you know, he couldn't understand how this was happening to all these women. And then he read our script and he understood. And he felt it was really important to help other people understand. And so he financed the film and we made the film in 2018. We shot it in 2018. So, you know, literally the Me Too movement made it possible to finance the film. People were suddenly interested in hearing this story. Before that, you know, we couldn't get the support we needed to make the film. So it literally affected it in terms of being able to actually make it. It also affected the ending of the story because originally in the script, this is a spoiler alert. This is going to tell you the end of the film. So if anyone wants to like jump over this right now, I'm about to give it away. But Rosa comes into the cafe, the restaurant. In my friend's story, it was the IHOP is where they went after this event. But Rosa comes in with the gun. And in our original script, she actually shoots him and kills him. And the other women in the restaurant, in addition to sharing their story, they wipe down the gun and cover for the women who take off and make it look like suicide. And so the script was written that way because we were feeling just so frustrated because nothing ever changes. There are a few scapegoats, but nothing changes. And then Me Too happened, and suddenly it felt like, oh, actually things are changing. And actually the truth is Anna Rosa, who plays Rosa, would never shoot this guy. That's not the truth. The truth is she wouldn't do it. Right. She wants to. That's her fantasy, but she wouldn't actually do it. And the truth of her story is aligned with the Me Too movement in that when she came forward, she decided to come forward and publicly share that this was her story. And the process of doing that connected to other women who had a lawsuit against the same perpetrator. So that idea of going from isolation to connection literally happened in her life in response to making this film and coming out that it was her story. So the ending, you know, very much is reflective, even though at the time she hadn't come out yet. And at the time she hadn't connected to other women, but it is that piece of, you know, life informs art and then art informs life, and quite literally art informed her life because in coming out, you know, and doing this interview with the New York Times, in their research, they found these other women who were suing this exact same guy. So this idea of the ending of the film changed entirely because of the Me Too movement and what was happening in the culture.
Wow. Because I, you know, that as you tell me that ending, I'm just as a viewer, I'm thinking no. And as you said that ending to me, I was just really thinking no, because I was just thinking about the sanctity and the passion, you know, that taking a human life, even though that's a great valid reason, and we won't get into a religious spiel here, but because I'm very spiritual and I just believe in that you don't wish death on people, is why that's so weird how it quickly went from that guy totally deserves it, but why would they do that just as an audience member? So it's really interesting that the movement created that, making it a lesson and not just if it happens to you, go get yourself 20 years in jail, you know. Or so I really, I had my hair was standing up in a good way on my arm while you were explaining that. Cause I'm always interested in how the movement has either had someone censor something or had someone push something forward. So that's really, well, you know, I think we have the most serendipitous film I've ever come across. You know, like I've told you before, just the serendipity and spirit, not spiritual being all cooking gumbo, but I'm from Hawaii, so we call it the Aloha Spirit. And it's just any time that you're being taken care of or something's looking out for you. Or so just your film really has that. Aloha is such a has such a great connotation to it, but yours is doing it for the right reasons. So given that it goes that far back and then you had this wonderful, not wonderful, sorry, let me cut that. Given that it goes that far back and then you have this situation that creates the wonderful thing that your film's going to be made, how long had you been developing or writing it before then?
Well, so Anna Rosa came to me. Let me take one step back further, which is Anna Rosa was working with me. We were developing projects for my film company, Full Moon Films, and we would come together to our development meetings. Each of us were working on individual projects and independent projects, and she would come to these meetings and hadn't done any work. And it was very clear to me that there was a block here. And, you know, I'm also a teacher, and I sort of jumped into teacher mode, and I was trying to push her through this block, and I gave her a timed writing assignment. And I can't remember what the prompt was that I gave to her, but after she wrote for this 10-minute free write, I had her read it back to me. And in the midst of what she had written, there up pops this little comment about if she becomes famous, a known actress, that she's afraid a tape is going to surface. And it was just that one sentence. And I said to her, whoa, what is this tape? What is that? Tell me more. And she proceeded to tell me this whole story. And I said to her at the time, I said, Anna Rosa, would you consider going to therapy? And if you do, because she hadn't told anyone except one friend at the time, she vaguely told about it. But this was like the first time she had spoken about this in 6 years since it had occurred. And so I said, would you consider going to therapy? And if you do go to therapy, would you consider letting me make this into a film? So she did go to therapy, and 3 months later, she came back to me and said, yes, you can make the film. So I had her go through the whole story again. I took notes, and she sort of gave it to me from beginning to end. And then I said to her, what do you want to have happen to this guy? And she said, I want him publicly humiliated, and I want to watch his brains splatter when I shoot him in the face. You know, that was her fantasy, and it was so compelling, the rage she had. And that rage, that really righteous rage, was what inspired for me the arc of Rosa, which allowed her to act out this fantasy, right? She also said at the end of the conversation, she goes, I don't know why, but could you just drop a little piece of Lavinia from Titus Andronicus in there? So as you know, Titus Andronicus becomes a very central image and theme for the whole film. But after this one day conversation we had, I sat down and I wrote the script in 5 days. It's the fastest I've written. I write usually pretty quickly, but that one just poured out of me, and I finished it. And we proceeded then to go raise the financing. We did immediately. It then fell through. And then it was 2 years to raise the money. But that was the process in terms of how quickly it unfolded and how much time there was around me thinking about it. It was very short compared to usually I'm like marinating my scripts in my psyche for years sometimes. I usually know when it wants to be written, and then I sit down and it's usually 3 months to write a script. But in this case, it was, you know, a day of marinating and 5 days of pouring it back out. So it was a really intense and exciting creative birth on this one. Say, in terms of those three parts, when Anna Rosa poured out her story, Pearl, played by Isabel Furman, quite brilliantly, I think, Pearl's arc is literally what happened to Anna Rosa. It ended, Anna Rosa's story ended when they went to the cafe, the diner in our case, and the IHOP in her case. So that was her true arc. And then, you know, this passionate rage created this fantasy that I wrote for her of the character Rosa. So Pearl is quite literally her experience, and Rosa is her fantasy. And then we added this element of Titus Andronicus, which I feel is such an important piece, because I think what it holds in the story is, I feel that oftentimes the silent scene after an act of violence is as harmful as the act of violence itself. And so, for those who don't know Titus Andronicus and don't know Lavinia, in that play written by Shakespeare, Lavinia is brutally raped by two men, and then her tongue's cut out so she can't speak of the rape, and her hands are cut off so she can't write of it. And I think this is a metaphor for the silencing that happens to so many women and men who are victims of sexual violence. So that was an important piece of the equation that Anna Rosa tossed in. She thought there's just going to be some little, you know, the postcard or something. And it turned into, for me, just a real core of the film.
What you're mentioning about the silence has, like you said, for women, I mean, we all know it's whether it's workplace, whether it's a situation, whether it's keeping that your uncle did this to you or your aunt did that to you. When you talk about the silence too with the men, I was thinking about whether or not I was going to say this on air, but you're just such a comforting person, so I wanted to share it. Was that another thing? And I'm just so forgetful if I told you over email, but something that your film gave me, and I'm only mentioning this because I want people to really understand the power of this film, that what it can really open up for you, is that 20 years ago when I got out of film school, I had taken this girl to go get a, she was applying for a job that it just said housekeeper up in the Pacific Palisades, and she was going to try to move to LA, and, you know, just said room and board. And so I drove her up there, and, you know, long story short, it was this gated house, and it said, you can't knock on the door, you can't come in. I mean, it was obvious they were very wealthy, possibly celebrities. So I just stayed outside, and, you know, 15 minutes turned into 30, turned into 45. And then finally, after an hour and a half, I was just like, you know what, I'm going to go knock on the door. Like, I don't care. Like, what the heck's going on? And as I was getting out of the car, she comes walking back just like a lifeless corpse. And she gets in the car. She's just like, that guy just like blocked the door and said I would have to have sex with him to leave. And then finally, after 45 minutes, he let me go. And like, don't ask me anything. I don't want to talk. And then for a 2.5 hour drive home, didn't say a word. And then like, didn't say goodnight, like never spoke to me again. I mean, I got in touch with her over email a few times. And she, you know, she'd play, say, oh, that's cool. How are you? I'm glad you're doing well. And then I just kind of realized, it hit me the other night while I was kind of going over some notes for the show. I just thought, you know, I know she knows I didn't do anything, or I wouldn't condone it, or I was 22, 21. So how would I have known to call LAPD, or what would it have even done? You know, she said that the guy had some Oscars in his house. And I was just like, and so it just made me realize, like, why was I mean, I wouldn't know where it was nowadays, but it made me realize like that silence. And I just thought that the fact that I buried it and I felt bad, and I was just someone who sat in a car, it really was able to give me just a speck of the perspective of what the silence is, because, I'd always kind of felt like I like took part in something to her, you know, like even though I can intellectualize and know I didn't, and I would have never been okay with it or listened to the don't knock on the door rule. But yeah, so in acknowledging that there is other people that have it, I love that you're saying stuff like that and that you're being, hold on, I'm going to start. One sec. Why do you always do this to me? You always make me start crying, Deborah.
That's my job. That's my job. And you know what? I hear you, and I hear the pain you feel around not having, called the police. I know that Anna Rosa has spoken about how painful it is to her that wow, this same perpetrator continued for 10 years after, you know, she was coerced by him. And, you know, she, I think similarly to you, had no, like, she, what good would it have done at the time to call the cops? No good. I think that's part of what's so powerful about Me Too, is that people now could call the cops. You could now call the cops in this situation and people would take it seriously and would look into it. Whereas 10 years ago, they just laugh at you. This was not part of the conversation. It was not part of the narrative. And I think, you know, going back to Shakespeare and why I put Titus into, and Lavinia into the film, is that this story has been going on forever, since the beginning of patriarchy. It is not a new story by any means. What is finally new, what is incredibly new, is that we are talking about it, and that Me Too has, you know, brought us to a place where you could call the police now if this happened and they would respond. No one would have responded if you called the police 10 years ago. Do you know what I mean?
Right, right. No, that's a perfect point. And that's, and I love what you guys did with that character and adding that in. And maybe on a subconscious level, that was something else that made the film. It was actually a good thing that this happened the way it did, because I would not have been ready to talk to you that first week. I would not have been ready to talk to Ty. So I want to really reiterate with people that this is not, you know, like, I always have a weird time, because it's like, I never recommend Schindler's List, because it's like, I don't want you having nightmares, but you have to learn about it. So this is not that bad. This is a film that you can watch. You can take, not leave. You can, you know, that saying, give or take what you need or what you don't. I hope that you have nothing you relate to about it. I hope that it doesn't open up wounds, because it's a fantastically made film. So we'll move into that point. As a director, do you have that's not connected to the Me Too or story, because that obviously amplifies lessons, but is there something that tape gave you as a lesson for yourself as a director, you would sit down and share and be like, I would have never learned that as a director had I not made tape?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I might have to think about it. The thing that was really interesting for me was my first three films were very much my own personal story. And this was in the same arena in terms of subject matter, in terms of what's important to me to talk about and make art about. But it was someone else's story. And that was a really powerful experience for me and very freeing. I think I'm sure I'll make more personal stories as well, but I feel like the next projects that are coming up for me are very much my eye on someone else's story. And I learned that I really love holding the space for other people's stories, not just my own.
Well, I just wanted to give you a mention before we continue on with tape. Actually, a little plug here for our upcoming guest. August 10th, which will come out on the 13th, we're going to have Mr. Robert Yeaman, who you guys know is from Wes Anderson's films. He's also done Drew Barrymore's Whippet, The Squid and the Whale, and one of my favorites, Drugstore Cowboy, Heather Graham's first movie. And then on the 17th, we have Jim Denault, who you know, Deborah, ASC. Jim has shot most famously Boys Don't Cry and HBO 16 Under. And then he shot a film called Hound Dog. And he told me yesterday on the phone, he wanted me to tell you hello.
Oh, I love Jim. Tell him hello back.
I will. He got very excited when I said that.
He was amazing, because we had actually, Ed Lachman had started shooting the film, and he had been able to come on to shoot Hound Dog because another project he was working on had fallen through. And we started shooting, and 2 weeks in, his other project, which he was contracted on, had gotten new stars, and they were starting immediately. And he had to leave Hound Dog. And so we were just together trying to identify who is the DP that we felt could step in. And it was hands down Jim, and he came on and he was amazing because he, not only did he sort of step into the framework that Ed had, you know, initiated, he then became, you know, he added to it. I loved collaborating with him. He was just incredible in terms of really being able to hear my vision, see it, and reflect it back to me even bigger. And he was just amazing. I loved working with him. I hope to work with him again. It was a great, great experience on Hound Dog.
Well, the vision was really apparent, and because I had just, you know, the reference of you and the emotion. Spoiler alert, I won't say what the scene is when it gets to something that's similar to tape. And then, of course, you have Dakota Fanning. I want to say that was probably when she was at her peak. So it was like, I remember being like when I saw her in Man on Fire with Denzel. And of course, I Am Sam with Sean Penn. But I remember when I was watching her carry it with Denzel. I just remember being like, this is, you know, this isn't a trained actress. This isn't a, like, this is just voodoo magic. Like,
yes.
Just when you're this old, you don't carry it with, you know, like
her performance.
Yeah. So seeing this in Hound Dog, and I just thought, you know, this is just kudos that you pulled and brought yourself to that. And then the way you guys captured it. So I was also kind of like balancing between, well, I'm watching the directing in case to talk about Deborah's process, but wait, now I'm watching the lighting because I'm going to be. And so it was like a really interesting research for me, which I've never had happen. I've always wanted to cover a film and be talking with the director and the DP. So that was like the closest I've come to where I was kind of like, cool, I'll hear at least a tidbit from her. And then when I talk to Jim, I'll bring it up. So yeah, I'm glad that, kudos. I mean, Ed Lockman, of course, you know, Carol and so many others, that's fantastic that you were working with him. So lately in the last, all the time, but really lately in the last few months, each guest has really been giving to the next episode. So I just think it's so cool that there happened to be that connection.
Yeah. Too.
All right. So that was great. Thank you for sharing those tidbits about Hound Dog, Deborah. And now as we just want to close out with another question or two about tape, and then we have our closing that, yes, is an homage to Inside the Actors Studio, but is not the same question. The last thing that I was so interested by process-wise is, yes, the actor knows he's taking a role to play a creepy guy. And I'm always intrigued by, like, yeah, you know, somebody has to play the bad guy and they're totally humble in real life. But from the director's point of view, it's almost like, I wonder how they cast Henry Thomas in the McMartin trial when all they had to really go from was, we're going to take Elliot and we're going to have them be playing this guy who does devil worshiping with child molesting. So what is just a little bit or anything you want to comment on the process as a director when you're basically just saying to someone, you're going to play the perfect rapist?
Yeah. Well, for me, it's essential that the actor I cast is a really, really, really good guy. My priority is to make sure everyone is safe in the room. So, you know, for all my bad guys, that's what I've done. And, you know, all my films to date have a bad guy. They all have a rapist. But, you know, in all those cases, it was essential to me that I cast someone that I really trusted and that wasn't a crazy rapist, creepy person. And, you know, in tape, Tarek was just incredible. And he was attached for a long time. He was attached to the project from when, right after I first wrote it. So he waited with us for the 2 years it took us to get it refinanced. He really, in a way, it cost him as a performer the most. I remember the day we wrapped, we'd done a really long, 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 long shoot that final day, and we all went home and slept for a few hours, and he called me. I don't think he'd mind me sharing this. He's shared it before, but he called me sobbing. he was in so much pain over what he'd just been through as this character, and he was worried people would think that was him and all the normal scary feelings, you know. And I think, you know, he really went there for us. And he had to go there if it was going to be believable. But in the process of rehearsals, you know, he really held the space for these two women in such a generous way, and that made it really safe. And, you know, of course, the actual sex scene, whatever you want to call it, after he's coerced her, you know, that's blocked out. That's so rehearsed. We laughed a lot while we were blocking it with clothes, and we did that, you know, a week before we were shooting. But more important in the rehearsal process was creating this safe emotional space for everyone involved. And I did a rehearsal technique that I always do, which is an eye contact exercise. But I made a slight change in this rehearsal for this film because it was Anna Rosa's story. In the rehearsal, I had the eye contact exercise, which is the two actors in a scene together are sitting across from each other, and they look in each other's eyes and just breathe for about 5 minutes. I make them do that, which is very intense. And then I have them get lines from the script, make eye contact, and say these lines. There's no acting involved. It's just about these two human beings connecting with this text. So I put Anna Rosa in the chair and had her do all of Pearl's lines, which are her, lines are her lines. Pearl's voice is Anna Rosa's actual story. So Anna Rosa sat in that chair across from Tarek and said the words that she reenacted, essentially, what actually happened to her speaking this text. And she wept through the whole thing. And she gave everything of her soul in that moment. And she did it with Tarek, and then she did it with Isabel, and Isabel played Rosa, and Anna Rosa played Pearl, and we went through the whole script with Anna Rosa pouring her soul out. It was unbelievable to watch, and in the same time, you saw Isabel almost absorbing it like osmosis, and I felt when she was then performing it, it was like she just poured Anna Rosa back out for the screen. And you saw Tarek take it in a way where he suddenly was holding so much, like the responsibility that was in his hands was so clear. And it was just this incredible rehearsal that created a safe container for all three of those performers to go all the way into it. And, you know, I really think, going back to an actor being cast as a bad guy, it could only be done with an actor who's as good of a human being as Tarek is. That safe container could only be created with someone, with a man that I trusted. So for me, casting bad guys, it's really finding a collaborator I trust deeply. And that's what Tarek was.
I see. Yeah, because I just always wonder that. I mean, I know it's acting, it's a craft. What was standing out for me was this John Singleton film called Baby Boy, where Snoop Dogg gets out of jail, and there's a scene where Singleton makes you think he's going to rape his ex-girlfriend. And on the commentary, he was just saying, like, you know, Calvin, Snoop, is like such a calm, nice guy. And we just had to do so many takes because it would get to that part where he threw her down and got on top of her. And he was just like, I can't do this. I wouldn't do this. Like, just even acting, it feels weird. Like it was, and it wasn't even about trained actor versus not. It was just about the human being in him just didn't even like it being portrayed. So that's why it's always intrigued me by, you know, just where the human part comes in. The way we close is with our little Inside the Actor Studio, Got to Miss That Show homage, is we just have four quick questions. There's no right or wrong answer. And so the first one is, you know, story's there, budget is there, who you want to work with is there. What's the genre that you have to do as a director before you, you know, hang it up or you're being forced into retirement? What would be that genre you would have to do that?
Well, it's the genre I think I've already been playing in, but I'd like to really go in with a big, with a giant budget and do magical realism, something like Pan's Labyrinth, that kind of size of budget and story. So it would be taking what I'm already doing, but having a really big budget to play with to be able to meet the vision I actually have for my stories.
Oh, okay, interesting. I like that. I mean, yeah, because I've usually it's sci-fi or it's crime thriller, but that's interesting. Doing what you're doing on with a larger scale or budget, I like that. I guess if you asked me what kind of podcast I'd want to do, I'd say mine with a $50 million budget.
Exactly.
Let's see. Exactly. I could send my jet to pick up a guest in Burbank and fly them to OC. And okay, let's see.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the other one's the reverse, you know. Oh yeah, I know, right? I had a teacher the other day. I told him, I said, "Oh, my career's going very well." I said, it was my high school teacher. I said, "Thank you for all your inspiration." And he said, and he said, "Oh, it's going really well." I said, "Yeah, a little bit past my dreams." I said, "But just like the power of dreams." And he said, "Hey, why are you thanking me?" He says, "Do you have $10 million?" I said, "No." I said, "But you'd be the first person." I said, if I could Vinny Chase Entourage style and send someone $10 million, it would be you. I said, so I hope that's uh-huh. Okay. So basically the other question is just reverse. You know, you haven't eaten in 3 days, the electricity's off, you don't see a dime coming in the near future, and I come along with a script and a budget, but there's no way you're going to direct to this genre.
I'm sorry, I'm not clear what the question is. What genre would I not direct, even if I needed the money?
Yeah, so like some people, they wouldn't make a Western film, or they wouldn't make a slasher flick, or like what's a genre or type of film you would not do, regardless of that you hadn't eaten and had no rent money?
Well, that's been pretty much the case. So, you know, I think that's it wouldn't be genre. It would just be story. If it's not a story that I need to tell, I'm not going to tell it. If it's not a story that speaks to my soul or my psyche, my dreams, my hopes, my grief, you know, it's got to resonate with me on some level. And then it can be in any genre. Right. I don't see a genre limiting my choice. I see the story limiting my choice. If it's a story that's misogynistic, I'm not going to direct it. If it's a story that exposes misogyny, I'm going to direct it, whatever genre it's in. Does it dismantle and topple patriarchy, to use Joey, now Soloway's company name, right? Is it going to do that? Then I'm all in, no matter what genre. Is it supporting the patriarchy? No, I have no interest. Is it holding up rape culture or porn culture? No, I'm not going to make it, even if it's magical realism and they give me $100 million. Is it exposing and hopefully obliterating rape culture and porn culture? Then I'm all in, no matter what genre you give me.
Okay. Really like to have conversations with people where I call it that. Sometimes it feels like you're walking through a landmine, to where you just kind of like, you know, I've just been open to learning every day, but there's so many words, like even the talk Kai and I had, there were some things that she mentioned to me where I'm like, one of the things I liked that your film gave me was the ability to have a conversation and in the safety, have it be okay to not know, or to know a word, but not know the extent of the meaning. A woman once told me, like, do I understand the difference between more women directing film does not mean no men do. It just means more opportunity for women. And to hear that so just put down, I mean, there was some cheesy 80s film Kai and I were talking about, and she just went off on this whole thing about how patriarchal it was. And it was like, I was like, that was an 11 p.m. cable movie that I don't even know how you saw. And so it was just so interesting to me that she drew this whole like thesis, wonderful feminist point of view. And I just thought, gosh, the producers put up $100,000, made $150,000, and it showed nowhere but Cinemax at 11 p.m. How did you get that from it? You know, so that's what I am loving about these times is just that the, you know, like what you were just saying, like the matriarchy, the patriarchy, the different gazes. That's what I loved about your panels. That's what I wanted to try. Well, I'm so glad that this came up. The panels, are those still archived so people can check those out?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. You can go to the website, thetapemovie.com, and all of the conversations are archived there. You can watch them for free. And I do think, you know, the conversations about male gaze and what I call, I don't call it the female gaze, I call it the female experience, because I think there's a difference there. For me, I don't go through the world gazing as a woman, I go through the world experiencing. And I think men can have a female experience as well, right? It's not gendered, but there is a way in which I think I, as a woman, go through the world experiencing emotionally. And that's what I'm trying to capture on film. I think that oftentimes, you know, in the process as women, in the process of trying to meet the male gaze, we perform instead of experience our lives. I think the training by the male gaze causes women to turn away from their instincts and intuition and makes them cut off part of themselves, you know, like in tape, their hands, their tongues, their rage, their grief, their pain, their sexuality, their truth. And I want to keep pulling focus from the male gaze to the female experience, you know.
I just naturally react to you. I don't mean, I'm not in any way interrupting or cutting off. You just,
you
bring emotion
like
out of me, I'm really trying to, because, I'm just, if I was remotely like on purpose with intent, like sexist to someone, like my dead grandmother would appear and smack me. And if she ever comes back, I would rather talk movies with her. So I just like, that was always my thing. So when I hear about these things, I'm just like, of course. Like, I mean, I'm that guy who has, one of the last dates I went on, the girl actually asked me to stop holding doors or standing up when she left the table. And I just was like, okay, I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable. It's just how I was taught, you know, like, I get up when my mom goes to the bathroom. I was just taught you treat a woman the way you want your mother treated. So, you know, I was not meaning
to do
anything.
Well, and you know, I think some women will like that, and some women won't. And I think we need to look at women as individuals rather than as, you know, an objectification of something to meet. The desire of a man, right? Each woman's individual. Right. And, you know, I think the patriarchy is not just harmful for women. It's harmful for men too. I mean, I focus on women's stories because I'm a woman and I'm writing from my experience, and I'm enraged still that women are systematically abused and silenced and manipulated, and that the best of who we are, our passion, our desire, our ambition, our hope, our love, our dreams, is weaponized against us. And till we can reclaim our own narratives, whether it's in a film or it's on a date, right? Until we can, I mean, we just have to keep speaking up and speaking our truth, even if it's uncomfortable for everyone around us. That's how things are going to change, right? I mean, I think for me, the most fulfilling moment in the process of making tape was when Anna Rosa called me after she'd read the script, and she told me she felt electrified, and she felt like the screenplay was changing her on a chemical level, and that she could suddenly move differently through the world. Like, she was once a blur, and now she could show up boldly and clearly and see herself the way I saw her, you know. And that's one individual and one individual story and one individual's voice. And I think over and over, if we can speak our truth, or as an artist, hold the space for one other individual's truth over and over again, that's how we start to change the system.
Right. Well, that, and also I feel like the openness, and that's something that you're, and I can completely relate, not specifically to the experience, but my experience with you is exactly what you just said, where I was 20 pounds lighter after that panel. So yeah, I can totally see where it's just being open to, you know, just like what we're doing right now, like just like you're saying. I mean, my grandma used to tell me there was things that she couldn't even mention as a woman. I'm just thankful, again, if you could one more time plug where the panels are at, because audience members, you've got to also see these panels. They're amazing.
Yeah, sure. It's thetapemovie.com. And on that, thetapemovie.com, there's links both to the conversations, like across the top panel, it says the conversations. And that's where, if you click on that, you can get access to all of the panels that we held. And you can also find links to rent the movie on Amazon Prime, on iTunes, on Google Play. So all of that, if you go to thetapemovie.com, you can get access to everything tape related.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining us from all of our team. We just want to thank you again for sharing your time and space with us. And of course, we wish all the success possible for the film.
Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate your support.
All right. You take care and have a wonderful day.
Thanks.
All right. Well, that was a wonderful chat with Deborah. And do my usual, whether it's morning, afternoon, or evening, or whatever other crazy time of day you've found during COVID, make sure and watch a good movie. Heck, get online and watch tape. Aloha.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, real conversation and movie-induced inspiration. Thank you.